Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thanks so much for being with us. This is the place to be on Sunday mornings. Why wouldn't you want to hear some homegrown? And now we can talk about a little epilepsy. Because everybody needs to be more informed on the things that are important to somebody in your circle. We have Dr. Fountain with us, Dr. Nathan Fountain, professor of neurology at the University School of Medicine. Good morning, Dr. Fountain.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're always pleased when we can have important folks from the University of Virginia. Dr. Fountain, I have you as director of the F.E. Dreyfus Comprehensive Epilepsy Program at UVA.
That's right.
You're interventional research interests include experimental therapeutics of unconventional drugs and devices for epilepsy.
So what that means is I see mostly patients with epilepsy, and that's the research I do. So, and that's a specialty within neurology.
And you serve on the board of the National Association of Epilepsy Centers and the Epilepsy Foundation Professional Advisory Board.
Right.
And that means you've been around for a long time doing a lot of very important work.
Well, I've been around a long time. The importance, I guess, is for you to decide.
Well, I think that it's important because that's why you're here with us today.
I think so as well.
And again, thank you for joining us. So epilepsy, I think for a lot of people that has sort of a rude and crude stereotype. So I'd like you to start by making that a little more well understood.
I think most people think about epilepsy or seizures as a convulsion, when someone suddenly falls to the ground and shakes all over. And it's a really dramatic thing to see. It's a dramatic thing to have, but a particularly dramatic thing to see. And it's often your family member or a loved one. And they often think of it in the context of someone who has other neurological problems. They sort of can confuse it or combine it with people that are neurologically devastated, someone with severe brain injury, let's say, or often children who are born with congenital problems, something they're born with that affects their brain that also causes seizures. And it's true, seizures can occur in that context, but that's a whole bunch of stuff combined together that's not really seizures or epilepsy. Seizures is really simple. Seizures are just, or a seizure is just an electrical storm of the brain. And that storm can start in one spot in the brain, or it could spread throughout the brain. And the kind of thing that it causes just depends on where it occurs in the brain. So the easiest thing probably to understand is an electrical storm or seizure that begins in the smallest, tiniest part of the brain, let's say less than a square inch, in the left side of the brain, let's say as an example, near the motor area. So you'll remember the left side of your brain controls the right side of your body. There's a tiny area in the left side of your brain that controls your right hand. And if a seizure begins in that spot, that focal seizure will cause jerking or movement of the right hand. It doesn't affect anything else. So someone looked down at the hand and says, see, this is what happens. My hand jerks when I have this seizure. And it goes on. It starts all of a sudden. It goes on for a little bit, typically less than a minute, and then it stops. And they're otherwise fine if the seizure doesn't spread. So that's an isolated focal electrical storm of the brain. And so if you start there, you can imagine that your brain, of course, controls all your functions. And so what happens during the seizure depends on where it begins. So if it spreads from that area of your hand to your shoulder and your face, then the shoulder and face will jerk as well. And if it spreads throughout the brain, then your whole brain is involved, and that would cause jerking everywhere. And that's the convulsion we think of. But because your brain does lots of interesting things, of course, seizures can cause lots of interesting symptoms. So imagine a seizure that begins in the primary visual cortex. That's the part of the brain that's responsible for receiving vision. If it begins there, it causes people to see spots and dots and bright lights and things like that without affecting them in any other way. So they say, oh gosh, Now I see spots and dots and bright lights, and that's all it is. Probably the most common and interesting kind of seizure we call a complex partial seizure. At least that was our old terminology. Now, what you call it doesn't matter, but what it really is zoning out or staring unresponsiveness, which is a weird way to say it, but it's a weird kind of thing to see, so we need some unusual ways to describe it. And during this kind of seizure, people will often stop what they're doing. So they sit. If they're sitting, they just continue to sit. They stare. They don't move in any other way, and they're entirely unresponsive to the world, even though their eyes are open and they appear to be looking off into the distance. And the reason this is so common is because it comes from the temporal lobe. And temporal lobe of your brain is part of what causes or understands awareness and consciousness. So this affects consciousness in that particular way. Now, also, the other important thing about your temporal lobe, it also is where controls your memory. And so after this little event, they're entirely unaware it occurs because it erased their cassette, to sort of speak. They didn't establish a memory during that time. So in this case, someone may stop and stare, be entirely unresponsive to the world for maybe 30 or 90 seconds, and then it returns. Sometimes, though, there's more than that, and that's when it gets a little more complicated. Because the temporal lobes are connected to other parts of the brain, they may cause people to do other things that are pretty much typical of complex partial seizures. A common one, for instance, is to grab things, to hold them, to manipulate your hands, or to have some lip smacking or other sounds like that.
So how many, I mean, so far we've talked about, just in this brief time with epilepsy today, and Dr. Nathan Fountain from UVA School of Medicine, specializing in neurology and epilepsy. Just in this brief time, we've talked about someone having physical seizures in terms of jerking functions, physical seizures like the stereotype goes along with. You've mentioned someone who stares off into space. Now you're discussing someone who sees dots and has no memory, was a phrase you used, cleared the cassette.
Right.
These are all separate parts of epilepsy, or do they all go together?
They're all different kinds of seizures. So pretty soon you're going to say, well, you just told me 100 different things that seizures could appear as. That's right, because think about this. That electrical storm of your brain could occur anywhere in your brain. And so any function your brain could have could come out as a seizure. And because it's an electrical storm and causes your brain cells, your brain region to do something that it normally does in some other normal context, but in this case comes out when it's inappropriate or not the time it would normally do it, it can cause that function. So, for example, speech, for most right-handed people anyway, is in the left hemisphere, the left side of the brain, and is controlled by a very small area, less than a square inch. And so if you have a seizure beginning in that speech area of the brain, then what you'll have is just isolated speech arrest, just like that. So you just stop talking, you otherwise feel fine, you realize you can't talk, you realize things aren't right, but you're otherwise thinking clearly. And when it's gone, you come back and you're back to yourself. So almost any function you could imagine that your brain can do, which is all the behaviors any of us can do, could come out as a seizure. Now, it so happens that some parts of the brain are more ticklish than others, more likely or prone to seizures.
You say ticklish?
Ticklish,
okay.
Yep, you might say. We think of seizures as being irritability, which is, I guess, sort of anthropomorphic. We're putting our own life experiences into what the brain does mechanically, but I think it's easy to imagine that there are different parts of the brain that are more or less likely to have this electrical storm of a seizure. And so one way to think of it, a little more ticklish. And the temporal lobe in particular is prone to seizures because of the ways that it's made. And that's why these staring unresponsiveness spells or complex partial seizures are the most common kind in adults. Well, some of those others I mentioned are more rare, but easy to understand.
What brought you into this part of medicine?
Really a variety of things. So as a neurology resident, so training in general neurology, then thinking about what kinds of things I would want to do after that to specialize in. Epilepsy is one of the possibilities. It was a bit of a long time ago now, so it was maybe a less well-formed specialty. But the things that attracted me to thinking about this were sort of on the one hand, the exact things we've been talking about, it's a fascinating thing to study because seizures are inherently interesting. Just at least to me, they're inherently interesting.
Well, I mean, for many people, and I realize I'm interrupting your answer, but you say that they're interesting to study, but for so many people, we go back to the first part of the conversation. When you see someone having a seizure, so many people, they don't rush to help. They back away because it's frightening.
That's right, and that was part of what compelled me to do it because if we go back 25 years or so ago when I started, I could recognize how many new therapies were being established. It was really exciting to me to think about establishing new therapies because before that, we really had 3-4 medications, and that was it when I started in medicine, and that's a pretty crude way to approach a problem that could be so devastating for individuals. So I was pretty excited about the opportunity to make such a big impact on people's lives, particularly people with epilepsy, and also really exciting to participate in the research to develop new exciting therapy.
So there's the experimental therapeutics
experimental
part of
therapeutics.
The introduction.
Yeah, that's a mouthful. And that's really, it's said that way because it used to be, I would say, that my interests were in drug development and epilepsy, but now it's not just development of drugs, that is medications, but also development of devices, different kinds of surgical approaches. And we're even starting a study very soon, actually it had just started, on exercise for epilepsy, so how to help reduce the frequency of seizures and make people feel better through exercise.
We are going to get into a little later in the hour on some studies and research at UVA. Is that one of those?
That's one we can talk about. It is at UVA.
Okay, great. Again, our guest today, Dr. Nathan Fountain, professor of neurology and epilepsy at UVA School of Medicine. As we talk about epilepsy, it is about 12 minutes after the hour today. So the electrical storm in the brain, what are the main causes of epilepsy? You mentioned sort of at birth. Is that when the majority of people have epilepsy? Is that birth? Are there other times?
Well, almost anything that affects the brain can cause epilepsy. So this is really a different way to think about this. So seizures are a symptom. Anyone could have a seizure. And in fact, we use seizures therapeutically sometimes. You've probably heard of ECT, electroconvulsive therapy for depression. In that case, we give people a seizure to treat their depression. And
Is that to shock them out of it?
Yep. So you shock therapy, which has a really bad reputation. This is not something I do. It's just to illustrate the point that we can make anybody have a seizure. So the seizure itself is a symptom of this electrical storm in the brain, but I realize your question is really, what caused that? Why does someone have this predisposition to having seizures? And it really is almost anything that can affect the brain. Some things are more likely. The easiest one to understand is head trauma, particularly penetrating head trauma. So someone ends up with, in a car accident and they fracture their skull, so they break their skull and it goes into their brain, which is it sounds horrible and is a horrible thing, but then you can imagine that kind of trauma, which is really severe, really likely leads to seizures because it sets up that electrical storm. But that's not really so very common. It's a whole variety of things, and it goes across the whole spectrum. So you could be born with something. If something goes wrong before a child is born and affects their brain, and then after they're born, that same thing that affect their brain in some other way could also cause seizures.
So genetics.
So it could be genetic, could be something they're born with that wasn't acquired but was in their genes the whole time, or it could be something that happened during birth. Genetics is in a way an easy one to understand because then it's in your genes. And the genes that tend to cause seizures are ones that affect neurotransmission, that is how cells talk to each other, or how the brain develops. So for instance, if you have a gene variant that causes your brain not to form right in a certain area, and if it doesn't form right, that also often sets up a site of seizures. That's also not very common. If we went across all these different things and said, what's the most common cause of epilepsy? Unfortunately, it is still unknown. About 40% of the time, so 4 out of 10 people that we see with epilepsy, we don't figure it out. That's good and bad. That's bad because we can't tell people why they have it, but it's good because it's not something terrible that affects them in some other way. Then there's another group of people who it's really obvious. They have an obvious brain problem that causes them to have other problems, like, for instance, trouble walking or trouble thinking. And those people, it's pretty obvious. There's some people in the middle that now have these known genetic changes in their genes we can identify from genetic tests, and those people we can identify. Among all these different people with epilepsy, most people are otherwise normal and perfectly healthy, so their thinking is not affected in any other way. We tend to concentrate on the people who do have these other problems because they're most severely affected, but most people with epilepsy are otherwise perfectly fine. They just have to take medication to suppress their seizures so they don't come out.
Are we talking about people here of a certain age? Are they spread across some sort of bell curve?
It goes across all ages because you might be, something might happen to you just after birth. So, for instance, babies that are born.
And I'm talking about your first seizure.
Right. So your first seizure might happen just after you're born because of something that happened right after you're born, for instance. Or it can happen in older age. And if you look at their first seizure, it's greatest just after birth, not surprisingly, because all those things that happen during birth, but also in the older age period, because that's when things like strokes and brain tumors and things like that happen. So although it's distributed across all ages, its incidence, its first seizure is most likely to happen in the first year of life or in the elderly after age 65. In general, the seizures that tend to come after age 65 are less of a problem, those that come early in life. But like I say, it's really spread across the whole spectrum of ages, which is hard for people to understand. People tend to think if it's genetic, you should have it at birth. But in fact, there are some genetic causes that don't present until adolescence, probably the most common identifiable one, in fact. And if it's acquired, you might think, well, it should just accumulate through life as people are more, you know, the longer you live, the more likely you are to have something happen to your brain. And that's kind of true, which is why it's higher incidence in older ages. But the distribution, although greater in the very young and I won't say very old because I'm approaching there, but the young and the more senior members of our community.
The AARP group?
Yeah, the AARP group, which is younger all the time, according to them, but are the greatest incidence, but it's also happens through midlife. And, you know, these are people whom you're sitting next to your 25 or 35-year-old colleague at work, and suddenly they have a seizure, either because they fall over and it's obvious to everyone, the big convulsive seizure when they get stiff and then jerk all over, and everyone recognizes that, or because they're having these episodes, like I mentioned, which finally they go to the doctor and say, well, this isn't right, and get diagnosed, and they're otherwise perfectly healthy. And once they start taking medications for most people, for more than 50% of people in that situation, they're not going to have another seizure, or at least they'll be very rare. And so you're not really going to think about it. You're not going to say, you're going to, that you sitting at work or even they might say, well, I don't have epilepsy. I just had a couple seizures. And from my perspective, if you have a tendency to have seizures, that's simply epilepsy. It doesn't mean anything else. It's not a psychiatric diagnosis. It doesn't mean you have something else in your brain. It just means you have a tendency to have spontaneous recurrent seizures, the seizures that pop up every now and then. And the idea of the medicines, they suppress it so the seizures don't pop up.
Again, we are talking about epilepsy and research, which we'll get into throughout the hour today with Dr. Nathan Fountain. He's a professor of neurology and research at UVA School of Medicine. We'll be talking about his work and the work of others as we continue 18 minutes after the hour. A quick question as we talk about some of the work. Is there a special diet for epilepsy? There seems to be a special diet for just about every medical problem, the right word here, that is out there.
Yeah, there's a few diets. Interestingly, the ketogenic diet is now very popular among endurance athletes, but the ketogenic diet was developed to treat epilepsy many years ago, about 50 years ago. Right, so the ketogenic diet, which is something that's pretty tough to follow,
I just read that. It was the ketogenic diet was possibly one of the most difficult diets to follow out there.
It is, but if you have epilepsy and it helps, you're glad to do that. But now that endurance athletes are doing it, we have all kinds of products available for them. So the diet went from something very obscure and difficult to now being it's still a tough diet to follow, but much easier to administer. That is, if you're a parent, let's say, giving a child, now you don't have to come up with all these what you might call crazy combinations of food. Instead, you can buy certain pre-processed. And there are things less severe than the ketogenic diet. The Atkins diet that people are more familiar with, or the modified Atkins diet, which is something similar, is also possibly used to treat epilepsy.
Interesting. Again, Dr. Nathan Fountain here today as we talk about epilepsy and the research that goes with it. Hang tight. Be right back. All right, Rick Moore here. Again, Sunday morning wake-up call on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. How progressive is epilepsy, by the way? I don't think that that picks sides in anything. Is there a, we talked about age. How does epilepsy strike gender? Does it strike race?
Well, the good and bad news for epilepsy is that it's ecumenical. So it doesn't have preference for men or women, for race, for ethnicity or age. Now, it is true there are some conditions. So if you do take a step back and think, well, epilepsy is almost anything that affects the brain, then, of course, there are brain conditions that are more or less likely in certain groups. And in that way, the causes of it can be distributed differently. But if you talk about epilepsy in general, it is equally distributed in men and women, for instance. As we mentioned, across the ages, although greater onset in the first year of life and then after age 65. As for progressive, there's two answers. So one answer is epilepsy in general knows progressive is a broad statement, but that's because most of the things that cause it are not progressive. So imagine the simplest one in which someone is 65, let's say, and has a stroke. And now they're weak on one side of their body. They're weak on the left side of their body, let's say, because there was a stroke in the right side of their brain. And they have seizures as a result of that, because that part of the brain that had the stroke is now irritable, as we say. And the seizures arise there. Those seizures aren't typically going to get worse, and their stroke's not going to get worse. We think a stroke is a fixed event. Hopefully it's going to get better. However, there are a few conditions that affect the brain that are progressive, and they do cause progressive problems and progressive epilepsy, and that, of course, is a difficult, complicated thing. If you think about garden variety epilepsy, if there is such a thing, in general, my personal view is that seizures aren't generally progressive. And one way to think about this, I'm not sure this is accurate, but it's a convenient way to think about it, is that even if seizures injure a few brain cells, a few neurons, and each time you have a seizure, let's say it injures a few, well, we have so many extra neurons, that is more than we need. You know, from the time I think we're probably smartest when we're 25 years old or so. And so from that time on, we're trimming off our neurons. And as you trim off more and you get through life, you get to be 65 and 75 and 80, and you kind of recognize you didn't have as many as you had to begin with.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so that we always notice. And so probably you trim a few more off with seizures. So if there's such a thing as garden variety epilepsy, probably after many, many seizures, it does start to affect you. Most people don't have many seizures. They just have a few, and hopefully we control them. For people who do have lots of seizures, it does sometimes give them more problems over time. And I mentioned before that temporal lobe epilepsy is the most common single identifiable cause of epilepsy anyway. It still constitutes a relatively small amount, but it's something that we recognize, look for. That does tend to affect memory progressively over time. And the good news is we have lots of treatments for that, including a kind of relatively simple surgery with a laser now, as well as standard surgery to remove that part of the brain where seizures are coming from. And so at least for people with temporal lobe epilepsy, we can fix it, although that doesn't really help their memory. That can be a progressive problem over time sometimes.
What about someone or family that has someone in it that has, we've mentioned someone who has a few seizures versus someone who has multiple seizures daily? I'm curious as to, and we can jump in now to some of the research or some of the issues that go along with that. I mean, everything we seem to have touched upon is, mentioned sort of the phrase upbeat, you know, someone living, trying to live a normal daily life because they've had a few seizures. You know, you can do that because we have medicine, because we have because we have surgeries, because there are ways to do this. You know, it's okay. The electrical storm in the brain will affect this and that, but we can work around that now. But there are people who have multiple seizures per day, every day, correct?
That's right. I spend half of my time trying to convince people that epilepsy is not a bad thing and you really need to treat people with epilepsy exactly with everyone else. And in fact, if we talk about the actual incidence of epilepsy, it's about 3% of the population. So 3 out of 100 people. So next time you're in an auditorium or at the movie theater, if it holds even 100 people, 3 of those people likely have epilepsy. In your family, you'd say, well, no one has epilepsy. I bet if you go find 100 relatives, 3 of them are probably going to have epilepsy. So it's very common. You just don't recognize it because there's no reason to talk about it when people do well.
Right. You don't put that on your name badge.
So on the other hand, about a third, somewhere around 25% or a third of people have persistent seizures despite the simple things we normally do. So that's about 1% of the population, so 1 in 100. So now we're talking about people for whom this is a problem. So I spend about half my time trying to convince the general public and the lay people, you might say, that epilepsy is not a bad thing for all those reasons. I spend the other half of my time trying to help everyone else understand that for those that remaining third of people, it's a severe, significant problem that really needs a lot of attention. I spend a lot of time trying to convince federal agencies, you know, NIH and so forth, to fund research to help us find better research and things like that, but also to help families and people with epilepsy understand what you can do for those people. Because you're absolutely right, that can be a significant, severe, devastating problem. And of course, it occurs across a spectrum from simple to complicated, or infrequent seizures to frequent seizures. But for people who have frequent seizures, it can be really difficult.
I mean, for some of the simple of those, of that difficult strata, I've seen the warning dogs. You know, you can, whether I've read an article about the dog in school or trying to get the dog in school, I forget where I was, in Virginia Beach maybe, traveling somewhere, and I saw the dog that said, you know, do not pet or whatever, this dog is here for the, similar to the, this dog is for blind, but it's, this dog is for,
yeah, service dog
for epilepsy. Talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, the service dogs for epilepsy are great in a number of ways. So one way is that they provide an alert. So if it could be an adult, although it's most often children that tend to use service dogs. If someone has a seizure, the dog can kind of keep the person safe in a way, or alert other people. So sometimes, for instance, the dog will lay on the person's chest and will keep everybody else away, or sometimes will bark to alert someone the seizure's occurred. So that's one thing they do. I personally think probably the most important thing they can do is provide companionship and security. You know, there's nothing loves you more than your dog. And so for people who might be in a situation where they become socially isolated, because think about this, if you have seizures, those people we were talking about with frequent seizures, it's very easy for them to become socially isolated because they can't drive. People might be uncomfortable around them if they have a seizure. There's the stigma you talked about. You know, I mean, we couldn't possibly do enough to help dispel this silly stigma about people with epilepsy and seizures. That it's, I'm not sure what the stigma is. Do people think it's infectious or contagious? I don't think so. I think in other countries they do, or possessed. So if you live in certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa or certain parts of Asia, epilepsy is thought to be a demonic possession, or interestingly, sometimes a deistic possession, so that it's actually looked on very positively in some cultures, but you can imagine that's just a few. I think in the United States, the stigma is people are just uncomfortable. What do I do if someone has a seizure, they say? And so I think we have to do what we can to help others understand that. So that leads a lot to social isolation, and so a dog helps in that way. And then the last thing is, some people say that their dog can predict when a seizure is going to occur. There have been studies in which it's been difficult to demonstrate if that's really the case or not. But you can imagine dogs have a certain sensitivity to them that's beyond what people have. I have a golden retriever. It's hard to imagine that she's sensitive to anything besides food. But there are smarter dogs than mine. And there are people who feel like their dog can predict their seizure. It's said that's not able to be trained. So the service dogs aren't seizure prediction dogs, don't predict it, but they can identify it when a seizure occurs.
Again, Dr. Nathan Fountain with us today as we talk about epilepsy and research. One of the other things, I have my wife's good friend has a daughter who suffers from multiple seizures on a daily basis, and she is currently trying to take cannabidiol oil, otherwise known as CBD, and there has been some work done in the state of Virginia to get that legal for patients, correct? In 2017, Virginia passed a law that allowed patients suffering from intractable epilepsy access to the cannabidiol CBD. Then in 2018, this law was expanded and taking effect immediately due to a, quote, emergency clause. But even though it's a, quote, emergency clause in 2018, it's still not being sold other than, I believe you used the phrase, artisan.
Yeah, this is a really complicated area for a number of reasons, but it's also a very popular area. So I've not had any more conversations about any topic in epilepsy any more than I've had about cannabidiol. It comes up very frequently. I could imagine that among your listeners, as soon as we say marijuana derivative, they're like, what? Okay, that's something I can understand. It seems like that's a good idea. People are smoking marijuana in every street corner in America, according to some people.
We go back, if we take epilepsy and you talk about medical marijuana, I mean, certainly people with cancer and taking chemotherapy, you were doing that on the, you know, sending people, family members were trying to help their mother, their uncle, their, you know, sibling by helping them that way. And here we are with, with another problem, another medical problem, trying to do our best. And suddenly the government is saying, we'll help this time.
Yeah, and it's a little bit complicated because there are two kinds of cannabidiol or CBD. There's the kind someone grew in their backyard, essentially, so stuff that's been around and illegal for a long time. And there's stuff that now's under research that's manufactured under strict processes and has been approved by the FDA. It's still under review by the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, who has to schedule it. Each drug approved in the United States by the FDA is decided to either be scheduled by the DEA or not. And drugs that have no abuse potential, ibuprofen, for instance, are not scheduled by the DEA. Drugs that have some abuse potential are, and their abuse potentials across five classes, 1 to 5. Class 1 means it has no medicinal value and great potential for abuse. So marijuana is Schedule 1, like is acid, LSD, opium, things like that, cocaine. So those are things that have no medicinal value and so by definition are illegal. And this is the reason that marijuana is illegal everywhere in the country. So your listeners are saying, no, no, not in Colorado. That is not true. Under federal law, marijuana is illegal in every single state, right? But what states have done, including Virginia, is pass laws to decriminalize it. That what they've said is we're not going to prosecute you if you have this in your possession. So what Virginia did is said that for a certain marijuana of one certain type, you could possess it to treat epilepsy. If we go back to the beginning, marijuana has two main components. THC, which is what we were concerned with through all the 70s. So the purpose of every grower of marijuana up until now has been to grow the highest THC concentration marijuana, because that's what makes you high. And that was the recreational use of it. That was the intent. But there is an Israeli pharmacologist, somebody who studies this, who found that marijuana contains THC, as we said, but also CBD, cannabidiol, the thing we're talking about. And here's what's great about this. Although THC makes you high and gives you the sort of the problems, well, or the benefit, but hey, look at it, of marijuana. Right.
The Dorito effect is right.
THC for sure. And then there's this other thing, CBD, that no one knew why it was there. And over time, it became clear that this seemed to be responsible for the medicinal properties of marijuana. But it doesn't make you high. So the CBD part doesn't cause euphoria. So it doesn't cause this good feeling. And it took a long time to figure this out, but the first studies of CBD, the first systematic studies were actually for epilepsy in the 1970s, in 1978. So related to this Israeli pharmacologist, actually, they did a small randomized controlled trial, so a systematic study of CBD in people with epilepsy, and saw that it seemed to help. So if we fast forward to now, just a few years ago, through kind of interestingly social media reasons, it became clear that cannabidiol could treat a very specific kind of severe epilepsy in children, exactly like the one you were talking about, frequent daily seizures, called Dravet syndrome, spelled like Dravet, so Dravet syndrome. And a family in Colorado was able to figure this out. And once that was figured out, then a number of systematic studies were performed, and that eventually led, just a few years ago, to this English company that manufactures CBD, and they were able to do studies in the United States that have just been completed to show definitively that cannabidiol is useful in these specific pediatric, so childhood epilepsy syndromes. And that was the basis for approval by the FDA recently. And now the FDA sends it to the DEA to come full circle, and the DEA has to say, oh, well, it's no longer Schedule 1 because it has medicinal value, so CBD will now be some other schedule. I have no inside information, but I'm guessing it's going to be Schedule 3 or 4, which is sort of like cough syrup or maybe Sudafed or things like that. So it'll be a low-level schedule. And the reason that's so important is because first, I mean, it's legal, sold like any other drug you get through the pharmacy. It'll be by prescription. It's a prescription drug. And second, I mean, it's covered by insurance because I'm sure like every other new drug, it'll be expensive. So cannabidiol is something that's everyone's interested in, but is more complicated than you might think to administer anyway.
It just seems, but it was originally in March, I guess, was determined that the current standard, and then has been postponed, and then postponed again. What are the reasons for it being postponed, correct? It was originally going to be released or put forth in its current setup in October, but now it's...
Well,
going to be delayed once again?
Yeah, it's another story connected to epilepsy. So the FDA, once it approves it, sends it, I think quite literally, the package over to the DEA, who then looks at all the information. And until 2 years ago, the DEA had as long as it wanted to schedule it. And there was a different seizure drug that had nothing to do with marijuana that the DEA didn't schedule for over a year. It was 416 days. I think they just sat on it and didn't schedule it. And that meant for that year period, people who needed that drug didn't have access because it wasn't available yet. So the Epilepsy Foundation was able to launch a project to pass a new law into Congress that requires the DEA to schedule a drug within 6 months. So that means that once the FDA approved it, it went to the DEA, and the DEA had 6 months to schedule it. However, they actually have... they sort of have a series of 3 month intervals. So I think they're going to have to schedule it by February, is my interpretation of the law. So it seems like it was repeatedly postponed, but it really wasn't. It's just under this new framework, it's going to take 6 months. And 6 months, I believe, is February. So they could have done it, they could do it in September, but I think it could take as long as till February.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Nathan Fountain from UVA School of Medicine, as we talk about epilepsy and epilepsy research. I've got a question or two to follow up on the I'm confusing epilepsy and cannabidiol oil, but maybe that's the problem, is no one wants to call it cannabidiol because it sounds too much like cannabis. So we'll hang tight and we'll be right back. And we're back in action here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, talking about cannabidiol oil with Dr. Nathan Fountain and epilepsy. Dr. Fountain, we're mentioned how cannabidiol oil has been postponed or delayed, and hopefully sometime in the next few months, possibly as late as February. Are there other drugs that everybody's talking about that the FDA seems, I'll use the term, worried about in their six-month delay?
No. So I can imagine that for the DEA, this probably has special importance because it's the first marijuana derivative approved for medicinal use in the United States. So this is really transformative, and I think that probably still requires a little more explanation. So we've talked about the brand name of this will be Epidiolex. That's what they're calling it. And once this is, it's now been approved by the FDA. Once it's scheduled by the DEA, then any physician will be able to write a prescription for it and say, here's your prescription for cannabidiol, just like they would for any other medication, get by prescription, give you a prescription, you go to the pharmacy, and the pharmacy will take it off the shelf like their other medicine and give it to you. That's fundamentally different than the cannabidiol that you get through mail order or that is used for other purpose. So first of all, as a prescription drug, it's regulated by the FDA. It's manufactured in specific processes, so you know exactly what you're getting. So you know the concentration of cannabidiol, it comes as a liquid. So the liquid you're getting, and you know it doesn't have contaminants, just like any other prescription medication. And doctors know how to use it because they know what the concentration is, how much to give, the risks and benefits, and it does have risks. Whereas the stuff that you order on your own through the internet, you don't know what you're getting because you don't know the concentration, that is how much of the medicine's actually in it. You don't know whether it has contaminants. So, for instance, the FDA ordered, I think they ordered 13 CBD preparations online. I think they found 9 of them didn't have any CBD in it. It was just olive oil or vegetable oil or things like that. And I think 1 or 2 had contaminants, things like pesticides, which you imagine are common if you're growing plants. So I think that's important for people to recognize the kind of cannabidiol they might get that I was calling artisanal. That's the term we sort of come up for the stuff right. You get that someone grows in their backyard is fundamentally different than the stuff you get by prescription. But because this is such a common issue, of course, in Colorado and in Washington, you can just go to any dispensary and get recreational marijuana of any kind, whether it's CBD or THC or however you want to make it. So you can imagine the DEA is now in this position in which they're going to have schedule, let's say 3 or 4, but a low, nevertheless scheduled drug available in a pharmacy, and someone selling it out of their garage. So can you imagine if Vicodin was available as a prescription product, as a controlled drug, but you could also get it out of the garage? You know, when you say it that way, you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. So I don't know what's going to happen when the DEA finally schedules CBD, whatever's going to schedule it, when we have people selling it out of their garage, essentially. I don't know how that's going to be resolved. Yeah. So that's a fundamentally different issue than every other drug we've ever really, in any context, had to worry about in the United States.
Can people in Colorado, again, we keep picking on that state, go get CBD now out of one of the dispensaries?
Yep. But it's not regulated CBD. So in the United States, people really don't appreciate this, that supplements are not regulated by the FDA. Only drugs are regulated by the FDA. So every time you buy a vitamin, say you're buying a vitamin D pill. It doesn't have to have vitamin D in it. They can put whatever they want in it and sell it to you because no one's checking. Whereas if you get it through a prescription, it's highly regulated. Someone's checking.
Right.
So supplements are different than drugs.
Right. I work for a company that, and I won't promote this company, but I work for a company and we make supplements for horses and dogs. And to belong to a national organization, you know, where we pay to belong, they purchase a product or two from us yearly to check it, which we have to, you know, they try and sneakily purchase it from us and then later on and test it. And then they charge us like hundreds of dollars for that. And we're like, of course that's in there. Who wouldn't put that in there? And then you say something like this, and we're like, yeah, I guess somebody else might just make it with olive oil. And
yeah, I didn't mean to imply most supplements don't have those things in it, just that in this particular context,
right,
you can imagine
some,
they might not.
Right, but somebody might not. But yes, of course, somebody selling it out of their closet, you know, Anyway, again, our guest today, Dr. Nathan Fountain, as we talk about epilepsy and research. I'm curious about some of the research going on at UVA. It's 11:45 here, so we've got some. I want to make sure to talk about with Dr. Fountain. The interventional research interests include experimental therapeutics of the unconventional drugs and devices for epilepsy. I want to make sure that we talk about that. So, but research at UVA, we've got a handful of things here. So I want to toss some out at you, and you can tell me a little bit more about them.
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing, maybe the most novel, is using focused ultrasound to treat a kind of benign but problematic growth in the middle of the brain called a hypothalamic hamartoma, which is about as big a mouthful as you can have, a hypothalamic hamartoma. This thing is in the hypothalamus. So for those that remember their brain anatomy, the hypothalamus is, or the thalamus is right in the middle of the brain, and the hypothalamus right below it. It goes right exactly in the center of your head. And a few people have a benign growth there. By benign means not a tumor. It's a bunch of neuron cells, brain cells, that aren't supposed to be there. They're supposed to be in other parts of the brain. So they're normal cells. They're just in the wrong place, and they're not doing what they're supposed to. But the one thing they do do is cause a very special and particular kind of seizure and epilepsy. The kind of seizures they cause are called gelastic seizures, and in gelastic seizures, people laugh or giggle. And it's mirthless laughter. They're not particularly happy. It's just that... they giggle for a little bit, and then it's gone, and that's the manifestation of their seizure, which, if you're like right now on a talk show, would be incredibly inconvenient, right? Or any other context in your life if you periodically giggle. They also can progress to bigger seizures, which is more problematic and cause other problems. So this is right in the middle of the brain, and that's made it traditionally difficult to treat. Because to get there, you'd have to traverse, you have to go through the entire brain if you want to do open brain surgery. There are some more recent methods to put a probe or electrode or a wire, you might say, all the way through the brain to get to the middle of it, to heat it up and ablate it that way to kill off that tissue. But what would be the best way to treat things inside the head is entirely non-invasively. So this new technology has been developed called focused ultrasound. And most people are familiar with ultrasound, for instance, when you think about prenatal ultrasound. So ultrasound when someone's going to have a baby. They have a picture of the baby in utero, so in the uterus, and you can see, oh, there's his head and so forth. So that's what people are familiar with, and that's a low level of ultrasound. But you can imagine that if instead of just having ultrasound in that one plane in that one way, if you were to use a magnifying glass, to sort of speak, or a lens to focus all that energy into one spot. And then if you put those lenses all over the outside of the skull, so all those sound waves were then all focused right into the middle or center of the brain, then they can provide energy or heat right there. And so then you could non-invasively lesion or ablate or kill off one small spot in the brain. So this technology of focused ultrasound has been developed or pioneered really at UVA by one of our neurosurgeons, Jeff Elias. And he's done a lot of research, as have many others. And now it's approved for treatment of essential tremor and tremor in Parkinson's. And we want to use it to treat this one very special kind of thing that causes seizures in the middle of the brain.
How do you determine, which cells are causing the seizures?
By an MRI. It's a pretty small thing. Typically, it can come in all sizes, but it's often smaller than the size of your fingernail, your little fingernail, let's say. And it's right in the middle of the brain. So once your attention is called to it, you can notice it. Interestingly, that's a very astute question because almost everybody I've seen, which is now quite a few people with this because of this research, their initial MRI, their brain MRI, which takes pictures of the brain, was normal, was read as normal. But then they actually had one of these gelastic seizures that someone recognizes gelastic. And as soon as you see a gelastic seizure as a neurologist, you say, oh, let's go look for an HH, a hypothalamic hamartoma, because it's such a special little thing. Then when you look at the MRI, you can recognize it. So it's a relatively subtle finding, but it's not impossible at all. And as MRIs have gotten better and better, these pictures of the brain, which is an also a non-invasive test, it's been easier to identify these. So you can identify it on the MRI, which is also how the focused ultrasound guides the sound waves to the exact spot.
So as someone from the insurance company, I'd like to know whether my insurance company should pay for that if all the cells are doing is causing my patient to laugh.
Yeah, because it causes more than that. So the other kinds of seizures it causes are staring unresponsiveness seizures, like we talked about, complex partial seizures, and sometimes convulsions. And because it's a very unique position in the brain, it tends to get worse over time. And sometimes when it persists into adulthood, which is everyone doesn't have it treated, it causes other problems. So they start to have cognitive impairment. Their memory starts to be a problem. Their thinking starts to be a problem. And a very strange, unique thing is sometimes it causes rage attacks. So that's I guess we're pretty far out into the weeds, but it can be just like the other things we've talked about. For a lot of people, it's a relatively simple thing, but for another group of people, a fair number of people with this condition, it can grow into something much, much worse. And when it's large, it could be a real problem.
It seems like the insurance companies are so difficult to, you know, they don't want to pay for much.
Yeah, in this context, it's not a problem.
Okay.
That's a good point, but it's not a problem here.
Right, and if we were talking about slight giggling versus that sort of what I was assuming would be not so inexpensive surgery, I would wonder if the insurance company would say, no, thank you.
Epilepsy surgery in general is really expensive, but if you look at the cost-benefit ratio over the course of someone's life, it's cheaper to fix their seizures up front with surgery rather than have them go to the ER and be hospitalized and have their other interventions and pay for all that medicine over the duration of their life. Most insurance companies wouldn't be so harsh as to talk about it entirely in financial terms, but in terms of cost to society, you know, no matter how you look at it.
I think that insurance companies are only harsh to pay about, talk about things in financial terms.
Yeah, from my perspective, it's hard not to imagine what you're saying, but if we give them the benefit of the doubt, I guess we'd say, maybe just the benefit you do to individuals would be helpful. That's certainly the argument we make. We say for this individual, we have to do this because it's the right thing.
What else do I have on here? I have a study about, here's one that I found that wasn't from UVA, though. A medical device wrapped around a nerve and a magnet used for help with seizures.
Yeah, what I mentioned earlier is that I thought it was exciting right now to be in neurology and epilepsy in particular because of new things, and devices have really taken off. The device you're referring to is VNS, which stands for vagus nerve stimulation. The vagus nerve is a nerve in the neck that regulates or gets information from things in your internal organs like your heart and your intestines and so forth. And it runs through the neck up into the brainstem, the base of the brain, and then that transmits things up to the brain. And for reasons that are kind of obscure now, historically, someone figured out that you could wrap a wire around that nerve and stimulate it. When you stimulated it, those impulses would be, through very indirect mechanisms, get back up to the brain and help reduce the frequency of seizures. So vagus nerve stimulation has been around for about 15 years or so. It's a well-established procedure. It's relatively simple. One of the branches that comes off the vagus nerve goes to the vocal cords. And so we typically implant it on the left side because the left vocal cord. And so when it's turned on and it stimulates the left vocal cord, it makes the voice a little hoarse. And that's the way they notice. That's on like that for about 30 seconds. Then after the stimulation goes off, then their voice comes back. And for most people, they get used to this and they barely notice. I mean, I might notice in conversation because I'm looking for it, but other people might not. I'm exaggerating this to illustrate it, but a lot of people wouldn't notice. The generator that produces the stimulation goes under the skin, beneath the clavicle, beneath the collarbone, and then the wire runs up to the neck. And it's all under the skin, so they don't know the difference. And the battery lasts now about 7 to 10 years, historically about 3 to 5 years, and has to be replaced. And it's about as good as a new medication. And for new medications for people who have persistent seizures, it means it decreases the frequency of their seizures by about half in about half the people. So it's not a cure, but it does help some people, and we use it when the medicines aren't working. There's another device that's implanted in the skull, a little microprocessor computer chip, that goes to wires that are implanted on the brain, and it detects seizures. When it detects them, it can zap that part of the brain to stop them. So we have a number of devices now that are very interesting. So, for instance, you mentioned your friend who has very frequent seizures, vagus nerve stimulation would be a perfectly reasonable thing to consider in that context.
Another research out of UVA was a monthly IV infusion instead of taking daily pills.
In general, because that electrical storm is caused by the way neurons talk to each other, almost all the medicines are based on blocking the way they talk to each other. That is through channels, through sodium channels, potassium channels, various kinds of channels. And we've been looking for something different than that because that's working for some, but there's a whole group of people that doesn't seem to work at all for. This is about a third of people with epilepsy. And so this new idea is actually a monoclonal antibody. So it's an antibody that goes against a very specific receptor on an immune cell. So it modifies the immune system. And so we're hoping by modifying the immune system, it'll help prevent seizures. That's a really novel mechanism, so we're excited about that.
I wanted to get this in. We've just a couple minutes left. Was it the story about a Charlottesville individual? We mentioned earlier about how seizures can affect people. This was a Charlottesville gentleman who had a seizure on a CTS bus, and he was kicked off because the driver didn't recognize the seizure. And now Charlottesville system is talking about giving video training to drivers. But instead of having a physical seizure where he blacked out and, you know, the stereotype of falling down on the ground and shaking, he started banging on the windows, and the driver pulled over, called the cops, kicked him off the bus, and the gentleman sort of awoke later and realized where he was on a busy Emmett Street. Talk about that for like 30 seconds or so. I mean, not to short you, but we're near the end.
Yeah, that's a common scenario that something happens, someone wakes up, something they didn't intend to happen occurred. This is not like someone who has sort of, it's not like a soap opera where someone disappears and doesn't have a memory. This is a very discrete episode that typically lasts a few seconds, maybe 90 seconds, then it's over. And so this is that kind of complex partial seizure we were talking about before, where someone stops and stares. And the problem with that is when they come back around and wake up, they can be confused. And so he might have, I don't know anything about this story, but he might have come around, been confused, started banging on the bus, trying to figure out where he was, maybe thought he was in a box, for instance, because he's not really thinking straight for a few minutes. Then that would go away very quickly over the course of just a couple of minutes. And about the time the bus driver pulls over and calls the police, I would guess, he's back to himself and now says, oh, what happened? And they said, you did this wild thing. And so it's really a challenge for everybody, particularly for law enforcement, to decide who's having a medical episode like this and who's having some sort of criminal behavior or a psychotic break or something like that. So one of the things I hope we've done today is to help at least help your listeners understand that there are some medical things like seizures that can cause these problems. And the key to seizures is they're brief. So the seizure itself almost never lasts more than 90 seconds. Although someone could be confused for a little bit after that, then they're back to themselves. That's different than someone with criminal behavior or other kinds of things that goes on and on.
And as you said, that's
one in a hundred.
One in a hundred. So look around the theater. Dr. Fountain, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Next week, we'll be talking to the executive director from Ashland Highland. Be with us.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SevillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.